and welcome to the Hear It podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Roberts, and I'll be speaking with guests about the campaigns, insights and ideas to better engage youth audiences. I really hope you like it. This week, we're joined by Rohini Karsh, Communications Manager at the Runnymede Trust, which is the UK's leading race equality think tank. From broadening the curriculum to exposing the Windrush scandal, the Trust's work is rooted in challenging structural racism and its impact on our communities, and has produced some incredible insight to continually challenge and influence progress towards racial equality. Rohini, thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Rebecca.
So tell us a little bit more about the Runnymede Trust and how the research and work you do helps give a better picture about young people's experiences when it comes to racial inequality.
Absolutely. So the Runnymede Trust is the UK's leading race equality think tank. We were founded in 1968 in the wake of Enoch Powell's famous Rivers of Blood speech and in the wake of the murder of Martin Luther King. And since then, we've worked impartially and politically independently to produce research that basically shines a light on all matters of racial inequality, racial injustice, to hopefully build a Britain in which everyone can belong and in which we can nail the lie on racism, as is what we were founded to do. Since then, it's been a bit of a ride. So there's been a lot of reports in the 55 years of our being, but significant work recently, as you just described, is things like covering the Windrush scandal. We've worked a lot on education work, so kind of diversifying and broadening the curriculum, particularly the history and English literature curriculums, but we're also doing other work with art, everything kind of ranging education, criminal justice, employment, health, housing. More recently, we've done a lot of work on the cost of living crisis in particular, and climate as well as an area we're moving into. There's a lot of links there between race and the climate, which people aren't really aware of. So that's a big piece of our work this past year.
And you mentioned just before when we were chatting about, in particular, the past few years, because of the pandemic and Black Lives Matter, it's almost shone a light on the work that you're able to do and also the issues that still exist in society.
Absolutely. And it's quite interesting because we kind of see this sadly, every decade or so, this big spike in people talking about race and racism. So before the kind of 2020 BLM protest, there was, you know, Mark Duggan's murder in 2011, there have been the Brixton riots, there's been the Black People's Day of Action, the New Cross fire, right the way back to kind of, as I said, Enoch Powell's time. What we see is these big kind of spikes in which people really bring conversations on race and racism and race equality to the forefront. And what's quite sad to see is that these conversations don't really change. Actually, what people have been advocating for have been the same, and it shouldn't be that hard to input. But particularly with the rise of kind of social media and a really, really engaged younger audience, we're seeing so much traction, and actually we're not reliant on kind of traditional print media or governments or even employers to champion this and make sure that it keeps the traction. And actually what we're seeing is now that just ordinary everyday people like you and I have the ability to kind of drive that change, which is, yeah, really good to see and interesting to see. And I guess we'll see how that progresses as we're kind of 2 years out almost from the 2020 BLM protest. And as you say, COVID, which it was impossible to deny the impact that COVID had on racialized communities in the UK. And that just shows how structural racism is. So I think we've kind of moved beyond the years of, you know, arguing that calling someone certain words is not racist. And I think most people would agree that that is racist and people don't do that. And that is punishable now. But what we are finding harder to kind of dismantle as a structural and systemic racism that is everywhere from our institutions to our society. And that is the thing that's the hardest thing to track down and actually dismantle.
Definitely the discussion around white privilege has been the thing that I've noticed more rather than just how an individual behaves. It's almost the systems in place. And I guess that's almost uncovered that there's no secret that at pretty much at every level of society, racial inequalities are impacting the lived experiences of children and young people. And like particularly the past few years, I've noticed like every stat I was able to find like a desk research for engaging youth was, you know, like black graduates, particularly male black graduates, even higher attaining graduates are more likely to be unemployed in the pandemic or first out of their job. Since joining the Trust over the past couple of years, what insights have really stood out as being the most surprising or significant?
It's a good question. I mean, sadly, you do also get a bit desensitized to it. There was a really interesting report that the IFS published, which showed the educational attainment rate. So traditionally, there's been a lot of discussion about, as you kind of just described, that certain people at school do worse than others. And what this report showed was that actually that gap has closed, except for some groups, including Black Caribbean and Gypsy Rima Traveller groups. There's a lot of nuance there. For Bangladeshi pupils, Pakistani pupils, Black African and Indian groups who are already doing quite well, and Chinese groups who are already doing quite well, that attainment gap is closed. And particularly for Bangladeshi groups, who I think were about 15 to 20 percentage points behind white British students, they now have actually got, I think, 5% positive. Don't quote me on those figures because they might be a bit off, but It's basically showing that attainment gaps have closed massively, but as you just described, when they then enter university, enter the workplace, they're still facing the same barriers. So actually it's showing this kind of, as we say, the myth of meritocracy for, I think, minority people in this country, where no matter how hard you work, no matter how hard you, or how much you achieve, despite, you know, for example, Bangladeshi groups, I think 69% of Bangladeshi young people are living in poverty in the UK. So despite living in really difficult situations, doing well at school, they're still not then being rewarded with the opportunities that they deserve and clearly are capable of achieving, right? So yeah, there's a lot of structural barriers, and that's always difficult to read. I think what's really heartening actually though is the work that we've done with Penguin, the publisher. It's called Lit in Colour, and it's a campaign and long-standing piece of work that's looking to broaden the English literature curriculum. And one stat that really struck me was that 30% of students in England now are of an ethnic minority background, but 70% of students who completed a survey of ours were really like, diversity is a key part of British society and should be reflected in our curriculum. And I think that just shows that matters of racial equality, talking about race in the classroom, talking about kind of our shared migration story, shared cultures, it's not something that is just relevant for people of an ethnic minority background, but actually people of all backgrounds. And actually what you might find is that, you know, if you read a book, for example, Girl, Woman, Other by Bernardine Evaristo, a white working class child might have more in common with that book or be able to identify with characters in that book, whether or not they're from an ethnic minority background, than any of our students would from kind of Charles Dickens or Shakespeare. Not to say that they're not important, and we should definitely study them. They're a huge part of British history. We can't just live in the past, and that has to be supplemented with characters, books, storylines that are relevant to children in our classroom so that they can engage with them and actually feel excited by their education and what they're learning about, and not kind of study something that feels so detached from their everyday lived experience and realities. So that was a really heartening thing, and I think is really reflective of the kind of position that Britain is in actually at the moment, and that which British people feel and think. It gets very polarized in the media, but I think ultimately everyday people are, yeah, they agree it's an important thing.
With significant issues like the cost of living and energy crisis at the moment, what are you prioritizing from a communications perspective to sort of shine a light on some of the critical insights you're working on at the moment?
So it's really interesting with the cost of living crisis. It's pretty terrifying. I think particularly post-pandemic, people have suffered so much already. But what we say, and I think runs true, is that the cost of living crisis only really became a crisis when it started affecting people it didn't usually affect, particularly our middle classes. You know, Black and ethnic minority working class communities and working class communities generally, they've been struggling with the cost of living crisis for decades. It's really disheartening to see how deep those disparities are becoming. We published a report in early October which showed that Black and ethnic minority people are 2.5 times more likely to be living in poverty. But the really shocking thing was 2.2 times more likely to be living in deep poverty. And deep poverty is something that's really easy to not understand because it's like a really statistical term, right? But deep poverty means that you are earning 50% below the poverty line, which is already exceptionally low. So 50% below that is, I mean, we're talking about destitution, right? And that is kind of unimaginable, quite like Victorian, Edwardian notions of poverty. And, you know, in 2022 Britain is just unconceivable. And that figure is getting much deeper, much quicker. I think we've had so much change in government. There's been so much kind of political unrest and difficulties that these issues have not necessarily been left to the back burner. I think everyone in government and in parliament knows how pressing these matters are. But it doesn't seem like anything is being done quick enough. The long-term structural and systemic things that need to happen to make sure that these aren't just, you know, like energy price cap guarantee or a household support fund, they're great, but they're plaster on a gaping wound. And what happens in April when these families then, you know, lose those short-term benefits? The structural stuff that really gets me, and it's really hard to, I guess, think about what it is. I mean, we know what needs to be changed and what needs to happen to reduce those structural inequalities, but we need the will and the kind of, because they're so systemic, we need everyone to get on board and actually recognise the importance of them and then really commit to tackling them and dismantling them.
Yeah, you mentioned it before that made me think about how desensitized we get. Like during the pandemic, when we're talking about death statistics, for want of a better phrase, it became like the norm. It became like Hunger Games, like, oh, how many people have died today? It was, I think, the news kind of agenda, we got desensitized to it. And I worry that with racial inequality and particularly the cost of living crisis and extreme poverty, like you mentioned, we're almost on that same trajectory, like percentage points or, you know, statistics. How, I mean, I guess from a common perspective, it's that balance, isn't it? You have to paint that picture of stats, and media do love a good set of statistics and to kind of share, but it's that almost like personal stories within that. So, you know, when we're talking about free school dinners and childhood poverty, I think it was an association of school workers who look after kind of catering were talking about how, you know, some children are pretending they've got lunch or eating rubbers to kind of fill up their stomachs. And it's almost like that shocking anecdote actually hit home more for a lot of people potentially than more stats. Like, that must be quite hard actually for you as a comms professional to go, these stats are awful and they're only getting worse. Like, how do we get people to kind of wake up and care?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's all about storytelling, isn't it? And showing the people behind these figures and statistics. I remember seeing a really harrowing video of a dinner lady who was like, she was like in tears and saying that like she didn't sign up to do this job so that she could turn away children that need feeding. And it's just such a stark thing when you actually think, God, like, there's queues and queues and queues of like 5-year-old children, like small children. Not that matters. I mean, it should be 18-year-old children, 25-year-old adults. Like, it doesn't matter. Having to be turned away at their school, at the place that's supposed to make them feel safe, nurture them, be a kind of safe space despite everything that might be going on at home. And they can't eat. And I think Marcus Rashford is fantastic at that in showing that, you know, he's obviously a super successful footballer. He's in our England team. Everyone loves him. And he kind of shows that, look, I'm one of those people. It's not just these kind of other people that don't exist. Like, I'm one of those people. Zayn Malik, I think, came out the other day. I think it's really important that those kinds of people who do have the power, actually, to speak out, do speak out. Because sadly as well, when you do see black and brown faces, they're not always treated in the same way as others might be. And you do need a kind of level of capital. But I mean, the thing that I cried when I read that story about Awab Ishaq, who was a little boy who passed away because of mold in his flat. Obviously, we're well aware of those figures. Like, we know that, you know, Grenfell obviously was very racialized. We know the shocking levels of both private and social housing in this country. Like, his story is nothing new. There's tens of thousands of people like his family who are struggling to kind of just live in a safe place. Like, that's the bare minimum, right? They're not asking for anything fancy, just safe housing. But there was just something about seeing that little boy's face alongside that, and then suddenly people being really outraged and just thinking, it shouldn't take a 2-year-old little boy to die for someone to take this seriously. And that's the place we find ourselves in. And I think you're really right. Like, people are super desensitized to these issues. And there's also a really fine balance between kind of showing trauma and profiting off trauma, or, you know, subjecting communities who know well what these kind of situations are to having to see them everywhere, as we saw, you know, with George Floyd. His murder was vital in kind of bringing these conversations to light. But ultimately, did we all need to watch a 9-minute video of a black man being killed to understand and believe that and get angry about that? And that's the kind of situation we find ourselves in, the social media era and the era of like fast news and everything has to be really hard hitting. It's a really fine balance. I think what I try to do in my comms role is just really explain statistics as well. So using imagery, using video where possible. We are also a small charity, so our resources are limited. Just explaining something. So like with the deep poverty statistic, just actually saying that is what this means. If you're living in deep poverty, you live on X amount a week. So yeah, just trying to bring those figures to life, show the people behind the figures where possible and where appropriate. But hopefully we'll get to a point when actually people can connect with them and understand what that means without it having to be some traumatic thing that they have to view.
Do you have any tips or advice when it comes to communicating with audiences experiencing racial inequality, or from a more strategic perspective, how teams might approach kind of really challenging areas in terms of how they operate to improve how they serve sort of minority or underrepresented groups?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really big question. And I think it depends a lot on what it is you are communicating. I would say always bear in mind language and tone. Language, the way you talk about communities. For example, we never say ethnic minorities, ethnic minority people, ethnic minority communities. There's this whole conversation about BAME, which is obviously a problematic term. I don't know anyone that identifies as BAME. I obviously don't identify as BAME, but that being said, it's a really important research tool. So thinking about where it's appropriate to use terms like Black, Asian, minority, ethnic, where you're talking about specific communities, if you're talking about Black Caribbean communities in particular, even within that, you're talking about Jamaican people in Jamaica, you're talking about Bayesian people in the UK. Within that, there's a whole plethora of people and communities. So it's about being really mindful of how you speak about certain communities, certain people's experiences. And I think also one thing that's really key is not profiting off people's trauma. Yes, you might be working on a story that's really hard hitting and it might really help you to have a case study and film them. But actually, do you want to subject that person to that? Is there another way that you can visualize that, showcase that? Can you anonymize it? Can you make them feel supported and safe if that is the only option? And how can you kind of safeguard those people that are already subjected to trauma and probably don't need to relive it every moment of every day? So there's a lot of that, which I think the media is, you know, we always have stories and then they're like, okay, what about a case study? And we think, okay, fine. But equally, is this the right time? Is it an appropriate time to speak to, for instance, the family of someone who's just died at the hands of the police, right? And just making sure that we are being really mindful of who it is that we're talking about and remembering that they're real people behind these stats and figures. Really, really context dependent. I think just being mindful of language is super important. Being mindful of the tone of voice is super important. Sometimes rising above the kind of social media fads and thinking, actually, is that appropriate? I think is something that maybe we all need to do more. And it's hard because that's the way you get people's attention. But being creative in that, creative in your messaging, creative in your outputs, thinking, how can we turn this into something that is sensitive and nuanced, but also will hit and land with people and make them kind of care and understand the issues we're talking about.
That's a really good point. Like, equality isn't a trend, and Black Lives Matter certainly isn't a trend. And I think there's a lot of companies guilty of wanting to do something good, but also perhaps not being consistent with how they approach that. And I think your other point around being mindful and sensitive to how we use and work with people with their lived experience is so important, because it's great when you're thinking about having a case study and you want to sort of help a certain issue. But within that, there's that kind of save your behaviour and that cost to that individual to relive that. And I think that's not really addressed enough, even down to imagery. And I think that's a really, really good point on there. Actually, you mentioned before some of the work you're doing around art. I don't know if you want to expand on that, because that sounded really interesting.
It's a partnership we're doing with Freelance Foundation, which are a kind of art education charity and foundation. We're doing work to make art education more inclusive. It's a big piece of research. We're in the early phases of that. We launched the project early 2021. But from kind of existing literature and statistics, we know that Black and ethnic minority students study art at really disproportionately high levels. So there's a clear engagement with art. This is visual arts in particular. But then that massively drops off as they go to university and then enter careers. And that's why we see the visual arts industry is really white. And then also because of that, probably isn't the right kind of inviting space for certain people to think, oh, maybe I can be one of those people that enters that profession or industry or space. Hopefully it's going to be a very joyful project. It's going to be very pragmatic and proactive. So it's not just going to be publishing research and then saying, oh, this is a problem, but it's going to be working with industries, teachers, educators, students to really understand what the barriers are and then actually do the work to dismantle them.
Are there any organisations or campaigns that you see that you feel do a really good job at engaging youth audiences?
To be honest, Penguin are great, I think. You know, you think Publisher, you think Penguin Classics. It feels a bit like random that they have such high youth engagement, but they're amazing and they're really hitting the nail on the head. Their TikTok is great. They've got a Lit in Colour TikTok, which everyone should check out. And they kind of were quite pioneering in the book talk world. So yeah, Penguin are great. And then, I mean, there's loads of like local grassroots campaigners who are young people themselves. So Choked Up are incredible. It's these three young women who are still, I believe, in school or college and have been leading this campaign against air pollution in London for a few years now. And they're super cool, amazing young people who are really driving change and actually like hitting where it needs to hit. You know, there's so many amazing brands doing a lot of really incredible work, but there is kind of, yeah, thinking about which brands are kind of saving their own face and actually which ones are doing the meaningful, genuine work. Stormzy, I think, is fantastic in the work that he's doing, everything from Murky Books to Adidas and you know, his Cambridge Uni scholarships. So I know he's not a brand as such, but he's really engaging brands to work meaningfully in areas and to actually do something that's really structural. So I think that's fantastic and a really good example for how brands can use their privilege, their money and their contacts to actually make structural change and not just do kind of viral social media trends that will just fall flat.
Thanks for listening to the Hear It podcast. If you like what you heard, please rate, review and subscribe, as it really helps others find us. You can also follow us on Twitter at Hear It Podcast or drop us a message by emailing info@threadandfable.com.